This is Tavia Gilbert, narrator of The Wives of Los Alamos, speaking with the book's author, Tara Shay Nesbitt. The Wives of Los Alamos is available now at audible.com.
Tara Shay, tell me why you came to write this book. What was the compelling factor that made you want to spend time with this subject, The Wives of Los Alamos?
You know, I came about it kind of from a side angle. I was living in the state of Washington in Tacoma, and I was interested at that point in this. There's a high school whose mascot is a mushroom cloud. They're the home of the atomic bomber.
Oh, interesting.
And it was just really fascinating. Yeah, like why does this town have this attachment to the atomic bomb in such a way? And how is it still in existence now? But it turns out that state is Richland, Washington, which is one of the secret Manhattan Project sites during World War II. And from there, I was doing research and thinking about the people that were helping building that project and not knowing what they were building. And I read this memoir by a female scientist who was talking about Laura Fermi. So Enrico Fermi was her mentor, great physicist. And his wife, Laura, I guess apparently never really liked her. And she was really befuddled by this. But the memoir is really focused on like how the atomic bomb was a good thing and just her fascination with the science behind it. But there were these like moments of intrigue for me. And I realized then that I wanted to go back and think about these families that were doing the science, whose husbands were building the bomb, and this way that then branched out to all these other secret cities in America. I'm thinking about things like culpability, like what do we support without our knowledge, and then what do we do when that knowledge is made apparent to us? And I think that's definitely true for those women, because the way that they then responded when they found out the bombs were used and that their husbands were even building bombs was really factioned. There were a lot of different reactions to that. And I think now, I think those are issues that are still here with us today. So that's a little bit about how I got interested in it.
Well, for someone who's never read the book, can you tell a little bit about what The Wives of Los Alamos is all about?
Yeah, I would say that it's, you know, a story that tells the making of the atomic bomb from the perspective of the nuclear scientists' wives who didn't know what their husbands were building. And it follows them from the moment their husbands come home one day and say, "We're moving," and they ask where, and their husbands say, "I can't tell you." So then they arrive in the middle of the desert in New Mexico. Through the way that they like establish their families and their lives and their friendships,
and a whole new life.
And then what happens when they find out what their husbands are doing? Yeah, really, really a whole new life. But it, you know, it's one thing that's interesting to me is the way class consciousness is taken with them from wherever they went, and it shows itself in this new way. Like, who has the bathtub? How do you get the bathtub? You know, money isn't the prestige. Tenure isn't the prestige. So these ways of showing in group and hierarchy are still present, but also it breaks down a fair amount of barriers too, because you're in an environment where you really need one another in all of these ways.
I loved that how the women needed each other, but did exactly sort of pick up life in Manhattan or Ohio or Berlin, and whatever their lives were before this big shift into an inhospitable environment, they sort of brought things with them.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just class consciousness. I mean, you've got some points of race consciousness too, which I thought was really interesting. The part where you talked about the wives putting their light-skinned children with the native light-skinned children and all of the native dark-skinned children in different classes. You touch on how this place in the middle of nowhere, miles from anything and sort of light years from regular culture, continued to be touched by any sort of class and race consciousness or socioeconomic consciousness that was going on in the rest of the country.
I think you're right. And it's, you know, it gets tricky looking at the 1940s. And of course, retrospectively, we can see so many things that are flawed. But the memoirs and the oral histories that women were recounting were fairly contemporary. Most or all of them have since passed away, but they were recalling their stories, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s. And they don't seem to have, some of them don't seem to have any consciousness of like, oh, maybe that was kind of strange, the way we segregated groups or the way that we would parody our maids in the evenings. There isn't that awareness, which of course we can have now, but I do think it's important. It's an important aspect of what was happening, and it's an aspect that doesn't really get talked about. The wives' stories don't often get talked about, but more so, I think, you know, they weren't just these women behind the scenes of their husbands, but they were also doing some things that are a bit questionable. And so I think that it's interesting to look at how power was worked out within that community.
There are so many things that I want to talk about with your book. I found it to be so remarkable that you obviously researched extensively. I mean, you would mention things, letters or photographs, and I knew, oh, Tara Shea has seen that photograph. Tara Shea has read that letter. But I never felt that it was thrust awkwardly into the writing. All of your research was seamlessly integrated so beautifully into the story so that I felt like you had done perhaps years of research, and then I had this very gentle and sort of rich whole experience of life. So you did all the work for me, and you must have done a huge amount of research. Can you talk a little bit about what you read, what you visited, how you put the research together to then craft this elegant novel?
I did a lot of research. There was that initial start that I told you about being that female scientist memoir. And from there, I moved into gatherings from the Los Alamos Historical Society. They put out some books. They put out some stories from the women. And then I listened to a lot of their oral histories. They have a podcast, but I think I sent you a link to that. So their oral histories. I was also trying to learn a little bit of the physics. My husband his background is in physics. He's an environmental scientist, and he was sort of helping tutor me a little bit on, you know, the basics. not that I really needed it for the novel, but there's so much information that I had that didn't seem like it would quite fit, but I felt like I needed to know it to tell the story. And I went down to Los Alamos a couple of different times and worked with the archivist there on things like twice a week they would put out the bulletin, which is like all the fun things that are happening in town, plus all the things like don't turn your water on because there's a water shortage, and, you know, all the army rules, and looking at a lot of photographs. So kind of just any way I could get a sense of what life felt like, I would do it. Initially, I read quite a bit, and then I just started writing because I didn't want, I was getting so many voices that I kind of wanted to see what would settle, what would come in. And the voice, the women's voice, came to me first. And part of that was I noticed a lot in the oral histories that they would remove from the, it was like this for me, to the we, it was like this for us. And there was this tension I saw between the individual and the community that was happening. So once I had the voice, kind of moved through everything I could remember in a way that was then filtered through the voice that I had created.
The voice of your book, I mean, it's pretty remarkable to me, and I want to read a little bit. It's from the opening chapter called West. You write, "We had degrees from Mount Holyoke, as our grandmothers did, or from a junior college, as our fathers insisted. We had doctorates from Yale. We had coursework from MIT and Cornell. We were certain we could discover for ourselves just where we would be moving." And I love that we, that you write this book not in the voice of one particular woman going to Los Alamos with her named specific husband, although, as I read it twice, I discovered there really seemed to be one specific person telling the story. Do you feel that that's true, that even though you never said, you know, June Miller and her husband Alfred moved to Los Alamos and this is their story, there was still a specific point of reference that held firm out of which the story was told?
Yeah, you know, it's difficult because I've heard people describe it like it's actually no voice. It's every voice and therefore no voice. But I see so many individual voices within it. But of course, there's some consciousness, larger consciousness that has access to, or it was like this for us, or someone said this, or someone said that. So I haven't thought about it as one single woman. But I know in my mind there were some women that I had a particular fondness for. There's one woman that I was thinking of, Phyllis Fisher, who she wrote a memoir in, I think, the early 80s. She addresses the opening to it, the little lady of Hiroshima, and it opens as an apology. And she's gone to Hiroshima, and she puts herself in the position of feeling quite guilty for her role in some ways, and she's apologizing. And she had gone, she's from San Francisco and was a social worker. And I had a real fondness for her and the way that she felt during her experience. And then there was, like, in contrast to that, Eleanor Jett, who was a boozer and a gossip. And, you know, she's the one that drove her and her husband into town with her kid. And she's the one that's like, great, we're not going to have to bring the piano, so I won't have to hear my kid play bad music all the time. You know, she's just sort of funny. And, you know, so I had all these different voices in my mind. But perhaps, you know, perhaps what you're feeling are those favorite personalities that were coming through.
Well, I think you nailed it when you said a consciousness, that there seemed to be a consciousness that was always at the center, that was simultaneously all-knowing about all of the women's situations, but also never felt like it was, to me, no voice or no specificity. I could immediately feel that voice was all-knowing and singular, so that it felt like there was a sort of beating heart at the center of the story that then could shoot out into representing the community as a whole, wives as a whole, as varied and individual as those women were, or then tell the story of one character, tell the perspective of one woman and her relationship with her husband, or her sense of her husband, or her sense of her responsibility or culpability in the atomic bomb. You were very facile and quite remarkable in being able to play at so many different levels at one time. I don't quite know how you do it, except I think that's what brilliant writers do, is confound limitations. So your story, with its unique voice, was quite amazing.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you. What is your next project about? Tell me all about it.
Oh, yeah. It's set in the 17th century, and it's telling the story of a transatlantic crossing from England to America. And it's really it's one of the ships that was part of the Winthrop fleet, so we're talking Puritans. But I think what's less known about the Puritans and those ships is that there were a lot of people on board that weren't Puritans, and they were adventurers. They were people hoping to make a profit in America, fur trappers. There were maids, and really interested in this family. There were three siblings, all under the age of like 12, who were sent away without their mother's knowledge on this ship. Her father took them off in the middle of the night and sent them away and signed their rights over to these Puritans who were going to be their caretakers. And so it's the story of one woman who has to leave behind her son and the Netherlands to go on this journey with her husband. And her husband becomes a large political figure. What happens with her, and then these siblings who have left their home because their father sent them there, and they're no longer with their mother. And so all of these people interacting on this boat together, and what happens when they finally come to America.
Sounds fantastic. Where are you in the writing process?
I'm doing research, and I'm plotting, and I have about 70 pages, so I'm hopefully I'm about halfway.
Well, hurry it up, because I'm anxious to read it.
I'll try my best.
Well, I'm glad that I'm so personally enriched by the experience of reading this. The first time through, it felt like something quite different than the experience of voicing it. I enjoyed the book the first read through, but the second time I felt like so much inhabiting it and being this universal consciousness telling a story from the perspective of we. This was our experience. This is our story. Was really a meaningful experience as an actor to get close to so many women and the story of this very complex time in our nation's history when the atomic bomb was being developed. So I am so grateful that I got the chance to work on it and to get to know your work as a writer. And I really look forward to your next project.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I'm, like I said, I'm just so happy that you got to read it and you're the voice for it in this way. And, the, and you know, you've responded to it that way. So I feel like that will come through in the voice in ways that we probably can't anticipate. So thank you so much.
Thanks for making time to talk.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this conversation between Tavia Gilbert, that's me, narrator of The Wives of Los Alamos, speaking with the book's author, Tara Shay Nesbitt. The Wives of Los Alamos is available now at audible.com.